Hello, this is Wendy Bauer, returning with the Decatur Herald and Review, February 29th, 2016. We continue now with the death notices. Helen Louise Balding, Decatur. Helen Louise Hill Balding, age 91, of Decatur, Illinois, passed away Saturday, February 27th, 2016, at Decatur Memorial Hospital. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, March 1st at Sharon United Methodist Church, Decatur, with visitation from 10 a.m. until service time. Burial will be at Macon County Memorial Park, Harristown, Illinois. Brintlinger and Earl Funeral Homes, Decatur, are assisting the family with the arrangements. Memorials may be made to Sharon United Methodist Church. Betty L. Garriott, Mount Zion. Betty L. Garriott, 87, Mount Zion, died Friday, February 26, 2016. Services will be at 11 a.m. Monday at Resurrection Life Church. Visitation will be 1 hour before services in the church. Burial will be at Fairlawn Cemetery. Kenneth D. Reynolds, Decatur. Kenneth D. Reynolds, 80, of Decatur, died at 10:15 a.m. on Friday, February 26, 2016, in St. Mary's Hospital. Funeral service to celebrate Ken's life will be at 1 o'clock p.m. Tuesday, March 1, 2016, at Maranatha Assembly of God, 555 West Imboden Drive, Decatur, Illinois, 62521, with Pastor Scott Root officiating. Visitation will be 2 hours before the service at the church. Burial with military honors by the Macon County Honor Guard and the Army Burial Detail will follow at Boiling Springs Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the family care of Diane Reynolds. Tanzius Logan Funeral Service and Care is in charge of the arrangements. Dennis Howard Robinson, Decatur. Dennis Howard Robinson, 74, of Decatur, Illinois, passed away at 1:14 a.m. Friday, February 26, 2016, at Decatur Memorial Hospital. Mass of Christian burial will be at 11 a.m. Wednesday, March 2nd, at St. Patrick Catholic Church. Visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, March 1st, at Brintlinger and Earl Funeral Home, Decatur. Burial will be in Graceland Cemetery, Decatur. Memorials may be made to Homeward Bound Pet Shelter, St. Patrick Grade School, or St. Teresa High School. James Lewis Bales, Hammond. James Lewis Bales, 78, of Hammond, died at 8:50 a.m. Saturday, February 27, 2016, at his daughter's home in Atwood. Visitation will be from 6 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, March 1st, at Hillegas Schrader Funeral Home, 66 East U.S. Highway 36, Atwood, Illinois. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, March 2nd, at the funeral home. Burial will be in the Hammond Cemetery with military graveside rites accorded. Memorials may be made to Carl Hospice or Mills Breast Cancer Institute. Oscar G. Philip, Jr., Pena. Oscar G. Philip, Jr., 58, of Pena, died at Decatur Memorial Hospital on February 26, 2016. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday at the McCracken Dean Funeral Home in Pena. The body has been cremated. Memorials may be made to the Cancer Care Specialists of Central Illinois. Joseph Wayne Nankes of Pena. Joseph Wayne Nankes, 78, of Pena, retired from Illinois Central Railroad, died on Friday, February 26, 2016. There will be private services. Arrangements made by McCracken Dean Funeral Home in Pena. The list of funerals pending for Monday, February 29th, 2016 include Wayne A. Day, 78, of Decatur, who died Sunday, February 28th, 2016, Brindlinger and Earl Funeral Homes. James R. Hoshauer, 65, of Decatur, died Saturday, February 27th, 2016, Tanzius Logan Funeral Services and Care. Mary Lawrence, 88, of Washington, died Saturday, February 27th, 2016, Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Donald A. Shoemaker, 85, of Decatur, died Sunday, February 28th, 2016, Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Harriet Streety, 100, of Decatur, died Sunday, February 28th, 2016, Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. And the list of funerals scheduled for today, Monday, February 29th, include Beulah Blickensterfer, 99, of Midlothian, Virginia, formerly of Forsyth, at 5 o'clock p.m. in Dawson and Wyckoff Funeral Home, North Chapel. Helen L. Brinkheader, 97, of Decatur, at noon in Holy Family Catholic Church. Betty L. Garriott, 87, of Mount Zion, at 11 a.m. in Resurrection Life Church. Barbara Whitaker, 83, of Decatur, 3 p.m. in Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. And now we'll read Prairie Talk. Ed Hungness for the Herald and Review, Playing a Mean Pinball. I reached into my own pocket, pulled out a nickel, and deposited it in the slot. My coin could be heard rolling down the chute, and with a click and a clunk, my adversary came to life. Lights flashed, bells rang, and the shiny steel orbs dropped into position, ready to begin play. The pinball machine was under my control, and I was determined to win a free game. This was as exciting as it got for a boy of 12 in a farm community on a Friday night. Although known to locals, Summers Sundries was a multifaceted neighborhood store. It was a drugstore, and Pop was the druggist. His son Dick operated the soda fountain and grill. There were 6 stools at the counter and 4 wooden booths. Each booth had a jukebox song selector, and 5 of the latest hits could be played for a quarter. Behind the soda fountain and wearing a white paper hat was Dick, who created generous ice cream sundaes, milkshakes, sodas, and banana splits. High-quality product motivated those in the area to stop and purchase their favorite hand-dipped flavor to go. A dime purchased a 2-scoop cone to enjoy while chilling out with friends in one of the cozy booths. In the pointed tip of each cone was a small piece of paper featuring either a joke or, if one was lucky, a coupon for a free ice cream cone. The little store had local notoriety for good burgers grilled the way you like them and enjoyed with fries and a fountain drink. I can still taste the Green River served over ice on a hot summer day. Other favorites included chocolate and cherry Cokes plus creamy root beer in a frosted mug. The store sold newspapers and magazines, bread, milk, chips, and a limited selection of canned goods. More than anything else, Dick and Pop always made us feel welcome. Just like Cheers, when you were there, everyone knew your name. On weekends, my pals and I often met at Summers. Each of us brought a handful of nickels collected on our paper routes. If we were lucky, the older guys wouldn't be monopolizing the pinball machine, a featured attraction at our hangout. For those not familiar with the game, the object was to score points by bouncing the steel ball between various electric bumpers as long as possible while racking up points. The game's surface was under glass and sloped toward the player, who attempted to keep the ball in play using flippers controlled by buttons located on each side of the machine. There were pitfalls awaiting even the skilled player. The ball could be taken out of play by falling into numerous holes in the playing surface, or by slipping past the flippers and going down the sewer. Always looming was the game-ending blunder called Tilt, This dreaded finish resulted from a player aggressively shoving or shaking the machine, trying to keep the ball in play. For a nickel, the player had 5 balls to play before the game was over. For every 1,000 points scored, the pinball player received credit for 1 free game, announced by a loud knocking sound heard by every customer in the store. A skilled player acquired a reputation and was revered by other players. The younger and more novice aficionados watched in wonderment as a pro racked up 5 or 6 free grant games on the scoreboard and only needed 1 coin to do it. By investing many nickels in our craft, my 3 pals and I honed our skills and considered ourselves pinball artists. No doubt we swaggered slightly as we entered the store, 4 big fish in a very small pond out for Friday night fun. And also from the Life page, New at the Library. From fiction, The Lost Time Accidents by John Ray. In his ambitious and fiercely inventive new novel, The Lost Time Accidents, John Ray takes us from turn-of-the-century Viennese salons buzzing with rumors about Einstein's radical new theory to the death camps of World War II. From the golden age of post-war pulp science fiction to a startling discovery in a Manhattan apartment packed to the ceiling with artifacts of modern life. Haunted by a failed love affair and the darkest of family secrets, Valdemar Waldy Tolliver wakes one morning to discover that he has been exiled from the flow of time. The world continues to turn, and Waldy is desperate to find his way back, a journey that forces him to reckon not only with the betrayal at the heart of his doomed romance, but also the legacy of his great-grandfather's fatal pursuit of the hidden nature of time itself. Part madcap adventure, part harrowing family drama, part scientific mystery, and never less than wildly entertaining, The Lost Time Accidents is a bold and epic saga set against the greatest upheavals of the 20th century. From nonfiction, Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning by Dr. Marion Nestle. Sodas are astonishing products. Little more than flavored sugar water, these drinks cost practically nothing to produce or buy, yet have turned their makers, principally Coca-Cola and PepsiCo, into proprietors of a multi-billion dollar global industry with strong political power. Sodas also happen to be so well established to contribute to poor dental hygiene, higher calorie intake, obesity, and type 2 diabetes that the first line of defense against any of these conditions is to simply stop drinking them. Habitually, drinking large volumes of soda not only harms individual health, but also burdens societies with runaway healthcare costs. So how did products containing absurdly inexpensive ingredients become multi-billion dollar industries, and international brand icons while also having a devastating impact on public health? Dr. Marion Nestle answers this question by detailing all of the ways that the soft drink industry works overtime to make drinking soda as common and accepted as drinking water for adults and children. Soda Politics follows the money trail wherever it leads, revealing how hard Big Soda works to sell as much of their products as possible to an increasingly obese world. But Soda Politics does more than just diagnose a problem. It encourages readers to help find solutions. It provides the tools readers need to keep pressure on Big Soda in order to build healthier and more sustainable food systems. And finally, for children, Mongo, Abuela, and Me by Meg Bedina. Abuela has left her house in a sunnier place and moved to the wintry city to live with Mia and her family in their small apartment. Even though Mia and Abuela share a room, the older woman still feels like a faraway grandmother because her English is too poquito for Mia to speak with her. But Mia won't give up. Embracing the role of teacher and enlisting the help of a bilingual pet parrot, the Mongo in the title, she and Abuela are soon full of things to say. And from the local page, state and regional news from Charleston. Charleston acquires new fire chief. This is by Jared Jarman, Lee News Service writer. As new chief, Steve Bennett hopes to continue to improve the Charleston Fire Department. We have achieved a lot of things over the last few years, and we are going to continue to achieve, Bennett said. Bennett replaced Pat Goodwin, who will retire February 24th after 30 years with the department. Bennett said he has almost always had an interest in emergency response as a career, the influence solidified after an accident when he was a teenager. One of my friends was killed, he said. That really pushed me over the edge to join. Early in his career, his preference was paramedic services. He began as a volunteer with the Windsor Area Ambulance in 1993. He then went on to work for Mitchell Jordan Ambulance, Decatur Ambulance Service, and then Coles County 911. Bennett joined the Lincoln Fire Protection District before ending up at the Charleston Fire Department in 1999 as a firefighter paramedic. He received the Humanitarian Service Medal for response to Hurricane Katrina. Stationed in the French Quarter in New Orleans, he and others were responsible for providing fire protection. Because the water system was down, fire crews had to be large with huge tankers filled with water. He said a caravan of fire service trucks had to be ready and on site at any time. Now, as fire chief, Bennett assumes responsibility for 33 firefighters and paramedics across two stations and managing a $3 million operating budget. Bennett noted Mattoon City garnered a Class 2 rank this year, which only 77 out of 2,351 fire departments in Illinois earn. This rating potentially affects the cost of insurance of property within an area. The rating is heavily affected by the abilities of the fire department, Bennett said, especially for a department of Charleston's size, it is an accomplishment. Tim Meister, the new assistant fire chief, assumes responsibility for emergency medical system operations, hazmat, and TRT, and public education and training. Meister began his career in emergency services, servicing as a volunteer with the Edge Scott FPD in Urbana in 1996, and served for 10 years. He continued his career as part of the Charleston Fire Department in 2000 as a firefighter paramedic. And an article actually coming out of New York, but which applies to anyone who ever flies. Senator wants plane seat size set. U.S. Senator Charles Schumer wants to require the Federal Aviation Administration to establish seat size standards for commercial airlines, which he says now force passengers to sit on planes like sardines. The New York Democrat told the Associated Press the airlines have been slowly cutting down legroom and seat width. One of the most vexing things when you travel on a plane is there's almost no legroom on your standard flight, Schumer said. There's been constant shrinkage by the airlines. He said he will add an amendment to the FAA reauthorization bill that is pending before Congress that would require the agency to set the seat size guidelines. Schumer planned to formally announce the proposal at a news conference Sunday. Schumer said seat pitch, the distance between a point on an airline seat and the same spot on the front seat in front of it, has dropped from 35 inches in the 1970s to a current average of closer to 31 inches, and seat width has gone from 18.5 inches to about 16.5 inches. He argues that the requirement is needed to stop airlines from shrinking those numbers even further. They're like sardines, Schumer said of airline passengers. It's no secret that airlines are looking for more ways to cut costs, but they shouldn't be cutting inches of legroom and seat width in the process. It's time for the FAA to step up and stop this deep-seated problem from continuing. Currently, there are no federal limits on how close an airline's row of seats can be or how wide an airline's seat must be. Schumer pointed to a practice used by some airlines in which passengers are charged more money for seats with extra legroom. He said that exemplifies the problem. It's just plain unfair that a person gets charged for extra inches that were once standard, he said. The FAA reauthorization bill is considered must-pass legislation, Schumer said. Congress typically renews the FAA's authorization every 4 to 6 years, using the bill as an opportunity to address a wide range of aviation issues. A vote is expected in March. And an article of the editor's pick, Budget Issues Cause Illinois Brain Drain. One of the drivers of a healthy economy is an excellent college and university system. In the past, Illinois has witnessed the advantages of having a mix of public and private universities and community colleges that educate citizens. Major research universities such as the University of Illinois can spin off job-producing companies at an astounding rate. But that system has been one of the many victims of overspending at the state level and the state's ongoing budget impasse. Across the nation, tuition has increased at a rate much higher than inflation. Parents and students who pay college tuition struggle to keep up. Add to that the state's budget impact on universities and colleges, ranging from a lack of solid funding for the institutions to the uncertainty over MAP grants. The immediate results are easy to see. Eastern Illinois University in Charleston has said it will lay off hundreds of faculty and staff members. Chicago State University has canceled spring break and says they are concerned about meeting payroll and other bills for the remainder of the year. The more far-reaching effect amounts to a brain drain, as high school students leave the state for educational opportunities that are less expensive. In fact, a study in 2013 found that nearly 40% of the most recent high school graduates left the state to attend college. At the University of Missouri, 20% of the freshman class is made up of Illinois residents. Contemplate that for a moment. Students and parents are finding that it is less expensive in many cases to pay out-of-state tuition. That's especially disheartening if you consider many parents have paid taxes to the public university system for years and will continue to pay into that system long after their children have graduated. But instead of having their children or grandchildren attend college in their home state, they are obligated financially to send them to a neighboring state. Public universities are not blameless. Although there are exceptions, the cost of higher education has been allowed to skyrocket, and students, parents, and taxpayers have often been treated as if they had bottomless wallets. So the time is ripe for reform. Universities have to understand that they need to lower their costs or at a minimum, maintain the increases to a reasonable level. State government needs to solve its budget issues and provide a reliable spending plan for universities and community colleges. Financial aid programs like the MAP grants need to be stabilized and funded at a level so that students who receive such aid can depend on it. The biggest problem with students leaving the state is that they often don't return to the state. Instead, they take their knowledge and skills and apply it in the state where they receive their college education. It is those states that are benefiting from the bright students that create new companies and new jobs. The budget issues of the last decade, inability to enact pension reform and unbridled spending, have put higher education in a vulnerable position. This is one of the areas where Illinois needs to invest wisely and keep more Illinois students in the state. And from the crime pages from Decatur, a 57-year-old Decatur man pleaded not guilty to 5 criminal counts, including aggravated battery to a police officer and domestic battery, after he allegedly grabbed an officer by the neck, threw a lit cigarette at him, and punched a woman in the face. About 6 p.m. January 2nd, 3 Decatur police officers were sent to a north side address to check on the welfare of a woman in her 40s who allegedly was upset because she could not consume alcohol, said a probable cause affidavit by patrol officer Brandon Rolfs. A younger woman, who had alerted police to the situation, allowed officers into the residence. When they entered, Terry Tate became enraged and began screaming at the officers present. Tate had the strong odor of an alcoholic beverage on his breath, and there were numerous open beer cans lying around the house. He began yelling at officers to leave while cursing at them. After he was told that officers were there to check on the welfare of a woman, he yelled and cursed whenever they tried to talk to anyone else. When Tate disobeyed orders to be quiet, Rolfs told him he was under arrest. Tate remained seated and refused to stand up. As Rolfs helped him to his feet and tried to handcuff him, he used his left hand to throw a lit cigarette at me, the officer wrote in his statement. The cigarette bounced off his uniform shirt. When the officer struggled to handcuff Tate, the suspect fell over a reclining chair and Rolfs fell with him. As soon as I took hold of his right arm, Terry used his left hand and grabbed my throat with force. Terry then tried to squeeze my throat. I delivered a single straight punch to the left side of Terry's face, which promptly ended his resistance. After Tate was secured in handcuffs, Rolfs was able to speak with the woman who reported that she had been battered by Tate. The victim told police Tate punched her in the face because he was angry that she had taken his can of beer away and threw it in the garbage. In addition to a bruise to her left cheek, she suffered bruises to her shoulder and arms, which she said occurred when he grabbed and pushed her. She said she believed he fought with police to prevent them from talking to her. Tate, who is free on bond under conditions of staying away from the victim and her residence, is due in court for a pretrial hearing April 19th. And finally, Gleason City asked for Sweeney lawsuit dismissal. By Huey Freeman, a Herald and Review staff writer. From Decatur, the City of Decatur and City Manager Tim Gleason filed a motion Thursday to dismiss a lawsuit against them by fired Police Chief Brad Sweeney, in which Sweeney is seeking reinstatement and punitive damages. The motion, filed in Macon County Circuit Court, alleges that if Sweeney's allegations are true, that Gleason illegally used a police vehicle to transport him to a St. Louis airport in May. Sweeney was in violation of the law because he did not make an arrest in the case. According to the Sweeney story, Sweeney, the top law enforcement official of the city of Decatur, participated in a Class 3 felony and failed to take action to enforce the criminal code against Gleason or himself, the motion said. Common sense weighs against recognizing retaliatory discharge under these circumstances in which a law enforcement official fails to pursue official misconduct, reserving said knowledge for his own personal use at a future unknown time and date. The city and Gleason are being represented by attorneys Gerald Stocks and Ed Flynn, both partners with a Decatur firm. The case has been assigned to Circuit Judge A.G. Weber IV. A hearing will be scheduled at which the judge will hear oral arguments on whether the suit should proceed. In response to the allegation that Sweeney's termination was a violation of the Illinois Whistleblower Act, the defendant's attorney wrote, "Where an employee has revealed this information only to his or her employer, there is no cause of action in Illinois for retaliatory discharge." The Herald and Review has filed a Freedom of Information Act request for the Illinois State Police investigation regarding the incident involving Sweeney's wife. Information received thus far indicates that Sweeney was cleared of wrongdoing in that case. Sweeney was appointed by then-City Manager Ryan McCrady to serve as Decatur's police chief beginning January 3, 2015. He began his career on the department as a patrol officer in May 1995. Gleason began his stint as Decatur City Manager March 23rd. He formerly served as City Administrator of Washington, Illinois. This has been Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review, February 29th, 2016. I look forward to reading with you again soon.